The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals are all here. The court is now in session. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Brian L. Walters, miscellaneous docket number 2016-12. Today, the issue presented for oral argument is whether the military judge abused her discretion by excluding evidence pursuant to Military Rule of Evidence 413 that appellee committed another sexual offense against Ms. J.C. Government counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Please, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Senior Judge Mayberry,
members of the court,
may it please the court.
I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Catherine Holder, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge abused her discretion by excluding the MRE 413 evidence involving appellee's sexual touching of Ms. Jason. Our Superior Court has said that a military judge abuses her discretion when her findings of fact are clearly erroneous, when she is incorrect about the applicable law, and when she improperly applies the law. And the military judge did all three of these things in her opinion. In this argument, I want to focus on how the military judge abused her discretion by improperly applying the law set out by CAF in the United States versus Hills, by improperly concluding that the MRE 413 evidence was not relevant to the charged conduct, and by improperly applying the MRE 403 balance test. So I want to start out with the military judge's application of Hills. And the military judge misapprehended the holding of Hills, and then she let her misunderstanding of that case permeate her entire ruling. Nothing about Hills can be fairly read to suggest that it's holding applies to cases where the conduct is charged in a different jurisdiction, as it is here. All we have to do is look at the plain language of a holding on page 2 of CAF's decision from Hills. And it says, we hold that because the evidence of charged sexual misconduct was already admissible in order to prove the offense at issue, the application of MRE 413, a rule of admissibility for evidence that would not otherwise be admissible, and that is not the case here. Because the evidence involving Ms. Daisy was not already admissible at appellee's trial. It would have relied on MRE 413 in order to be admissible. So we looked at what some of the other federal circuits have done with cases like this. The case of United States v. Rogers, which is cited in our brief, it does involve a situation where we have instances of conduct that might be charged in two different proceedings. And in that case, in Rogers, there's a 2006 and a 2005, there's a 2006 and 2005 incident. And then there was a prior conviction under that occurred in 2009. And the 2006 and 2005 incidents, they were both charged, but then they were eventually bifurcated or essentially severed. And so the question in front of the court, the Seventh Circuit in Rogers, was whether or not it was an error in the government appeal. So whether or not it was an error for in the proceeding involving the 2006 conduct, whether it was error to exclude the 2005 conduct, which is still currently charged and pending in a bifurcated proceeding, and 2001. And so the court in that case, it was not even a question of whether or not it is proper to bring in conduct that is charged in a different proceeding in that case. And so the court, Seventh Circuit, ended up overturning the trial of the district court's decision to exclude the Fourth Amendment on appeal and sent it back for further proceedings. So I think that implication helped other circuits treat this issue. But if you look at the legislative history, and I think that's important because in part of passing the Union Board decision in Huntington and Hills is the fact that the legislative history only talks about uncharged misconduct and doesn't say anything about bringing in charged conduct. But if you look at the David Park Law Review article that is cited in the government's brief and is also mentioned by Hills, or Captain Hills, would be something that should be considered part of the legislative history of 413. Part in that article is talking about why 413 should allow admission of evidence of sexual offenses, even if they haven't necessarily been prosecuted or resulted in a conviction. And Park says, it is often impossible to join all offenses for trial in a single form. This occurs, for example, in the case of a rapist or child molester who commits crimes in a number of different states, or who commits some crimes in state jurisdiction and others in federal jurisdiction. If a jury is to be made aware of all relevant criminal conduct of the defendant, this can only be accomplished in such a case through the admission of evidence of uncharged crimes. So in this case, we have exactly what the drafters were envisioning. We have the accused who is charged in federal jurisdiction at a court-martial under the jurisdiction of the military, and then we have an accused who is charged in state court. But even though the uncharged conduct is charged in different jurisdictions, the Air Force can still make use of that misconduct under 413 to make the members aware of all of Appellee's relevant criminal conduct. Now I want to move along and talk about how the military judge can properly apply the third threshold factor. And that third threshold factor of right asks whether the evidence at issue was relevant under MRE 401 and 402. And the military judge, she also mythified this factor. And she really lets her Hill's ruling infect her analysis of this factor. You can see it seems as if she's operating under an incorrect presumption that Hill has somehow changed the analysis in Wright when it comes to relevancy. She says in her ruling, the unproven allegation of a completely separate alleged unproven incident regarding a completely different set of facts and alleged victim is arguably not relevant to the conduct at issue in this court-martial. And that reasoning goes completely against the purpose of MRE 413. If we look at what this court said back in Durell, it said that when you look at relevancy under 401 and 402 for purposes of 413, that relevancy is almost mandated. Because when we talk about propensity is generally considered to be highly probative. The one problem with propensity evidence is that sometimes on certain occasions it may be more prejudicial. And that's the traditional reason for excluding it under 404B, for example. But Congress made very clear when they passed legislation that called for the drafting of Federal Rule of Evidence 413, they made very clear that they intended to change that and that propensity evidence was indeed supposed to be admissible. But nonetheless, the military judge in this case appeared to suggest that propensity evidence in this case, because it was unproven and it hadn't resulted in a conviction, that it had no relevance at all. But when we look at what courts have said, be it our superior court, be it this court, be it federal court, what they have said about Rule 413, they talk about why. What are the possible ways that propensity or the evidence of other sexual acts, how they can be relevant. And so propensity is really just one of them. But also, they can show, and they do show in this particular case, that Appellee lacks the moral inhibitions to keep him from committing sexual offenses, that he isn't deterred from committing sexual offenses by the threat of criminal sanction. And I think that's charged misconduct in January of 2016. And then the charges were referred to trial in the 22nd of April 2016. And then it was a couple months later with this court martial hanging over his head that he committed the uncharged offenses against MJC because those occurred on the 4th of July 2016. So again, it tends to show that this threat of criminal sanction is not a deterrent to appellee, and it's relevant for that particular purpose. Finally, it also is relevant to show that it's improbable that Staff Sergeant RM, who's the named victim of the charge at the court martial, that she has falsely accused appellee. The federal courts have talked about how that's the importance of having 413 evidence, and Kat also recognized it in Hill. Very often consent is at issue in sexual assault cases, unlike most violent crimes. Oftentimes, these type of cases turn into swearing matches, and so in that case, the evidence is relevant to give more credibility to the testimony of the victim and the named charges. So I'd like to move on and talk about how the military judge improperly applied the 403 balancing test in this case. And so she did so in three main ways. First, she did not use the correct standard. And the correct standard in this case was whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. She did not analyze any of the factors that might weigh in favor of the government, especially the similarities between the acts, and she did not conduct the balancing test in a broad manner that favored admission. Now, our superior court in Roberts said that the military judge abuses her discretion when she is incorrect about the applicable law. And here, she was incorrect about the applicable law because she used the wrong standard. Instead of talking about unfair prejudice and a substantial outweighing of the probative value, she talked about evidence being highly prejudicial. And words absolutely do matter, Your Honor. The federal courts, such as, for example, the 2nd, the 5th, and the 7th Circuits, and Dillon, Davis, and Siebel, which are all cited in our brief, they have recognized that there's a difference between something that is highly prejudicial and something that is unfairly prejudicial. Something can be highly prejudicial and still be admissible. Like a confession is highly prejudicial, but that doesn't mean that it's normally going to be excluded under.
And counsel, you cited, I think it was the Air Force's decision in Durell, correct?
Yes, Your
Honor. You look at CAF's then opinion in Durell. They addressed the military judge's 403 balancing test. And that judge, and I'm looking at it, really didn't articulate the standard verbatim under 403, and CAF said that was a thorough and proper balancing. And the judge in this case, in her written ruling, did cite 403 correctly. And so is your position that, although in her analysis she didn't use unfair or substantial, that she applied the wrong standard?
Yes. She didn't do anything to describe how there was unfair prejudice, Your Honor. And if we look at what some of the courts have said when talking about what it means for something to be unfairly prejudicial in the context of 403, when you're admitting 413 evidence, what federal courts have said in Rogers, the 7th Circuit, said that in passing 413, Congress took away the idea that propensity by itself is just always going to be unfair prejudice. So you're looking at whether or not the evidence that is presented is going to tend to make the members come to a decision on an improper basis. And a lot of times it's going to be, well, does it cause them to make a decision on an emotional basis? And there's no indication that would be the case. I mean, there are a lot of similarities between the charged and uncharged offense, and probably, although both are unacceptable, certainly the uncharged offense, may be slightly less egregious just because of the part of the body that was touched, maybe slightly less egregious than the charged offense.
And so it's not the type of conduct that is going to cause the members to make, you know, to be blinded by, you know, the odiousness and make an improper decision. This, I think Barry is sort of the gold standard case for unfair prejudice, because in that case, you had an accused who, the 413, he committed a sexual assault as an adult, and that's what he was charged with. And 413 evidence that was admitted was when he committed when he was 13 against a six-year-old. So essentially, you were having an accused who's charged with an adult offense being able to be labeled as a child molester, which is probably the worst thing that you can call someone. And so for that reason, Kath and Barry found that there was unfair prejudice. But that danger simply is not here in this case. And so the military judge did nothing to articulate why the prejudice was unfair. He just sort of made a conclusory statement that it was highly prejudicial and more prejudicial than probative. And really, from looking at the case law surrounding 413, she needed to do more to articulate why.
How much more did she need to do?
Well, Your Honor, one thing we would certainly say is that she needs to go through all of the factors and really do a balancing of the factors rather than just go through the factors that potentially weighed against admission. There were a lot of factors that weighed in favor of the admission that she just did not talk about, especially such as the similarity of the offense. And we can look at several cases from our superior court, Your Honor, that have criticized military judges for doing incomplete force or balancing tests. And I think we can start with Solomon. And in Solomon, our superior court found that failure to deal with important facts that were on the record, in this case it was alibi evidence, and failure to give due weight to that in the 403 balancing test was error. In Barry, the aforementioned case that I was talking about, the military judge found that it was an abuse of discretion. And as part of finding abuse of discretion, Cap found that the military judge did not address all of the right factors, and the only ones he talked about were ones that supported admission. And so we're going the other way here because this is a government appeal, but I wouldn't say just because it's in favor of the government or in favor of the accused that in any way relieves the military judge of the ability to do a very thorough balancing.
One of the factors that the court addressed in Barry that the judge did not was possible distraction to the fact finder, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the concern that this evidence would result in a distracting mini-trial on a collateral issue. And that squarely was one of the judge's reasons under 403 for excluding the evidence in this case. And the right factors are not exhaustive, correct?
That's right.
And one can control.
Yes, Your Honor, that probably one could weigh more than others if all factors had been balanced.
Well, does it necessarily have to be all of them, is my question.
I do think so, Your Honor. I think when the similarities between the offenses and the probative value was as strong as it was in this case, I think that does indeed need to be discussed. And I think we also have to look at the fact that the military judge is conducting, she starts off poorly or on the wrong foot, because she's already, based on her ruling and her application of Hills, she's sort of operating under the assumption that this evidence is not very relevant, but that's not the case.
Well, not logically relevant at all, she finds. Correct.
Right, she says it's not logically relevant at all. And so, I mean, certainly that had to have also infected her analysis of legal relevance when she did the 403 balancing test. And so when you're starting off on the wrong foot like that, with a incorrectly diminished view of how strong or how probative that evidence is, it certainly is going to taint her entire ruling when it comes to 403, and she's entitled to less deference. She didn't discuss, because she did not do a thorough balancing test on the record and look at all factors, certainly she's entitled to less deference than if she had gone through all of the factors and truly weighed them. But, Your Honor, I do want to take an opportunity, because you mentioned the the distraction of fact finder factor, because I also think that the military judge did not correctly analyze that. If she didn't correctly analyze that factor, she talks about in her ruling in paragraph 32. She talks about how the evidence, or putting on this evidence, would require multiple witnesses, and that's not exactly accurate. Really, the only witness that was actually needed was one. It was Ms. J.C. And the military judge has discretion to limit testimony if it's going to become distracting. But she didn't talk about whether or not there were any ways to do that. And I think we have to keep in mind
that... Well, she did. She also has a discretion to exclude evidence under 403, and that's exactly what she did in this case.
Well, she does, Your Honor, but I think we have to remember that the courts have very strongly said that 403 balancing test has to be applied in a broad manner to give MRE 413 its intended effect. And by not even considering or talking about whether or not there were other ways for this evidence to be presented that might be potentially less distracting, she abused her discretion, and she didn't apply 413 and 403 balancing test in light of strong legislative intent that this type of evidence be admissible. I think, and I've cited Rogers several times, but I think that that's a very helpful case for this court. But Rogers, in sending the case back, overturning, vacating the military judge, or the district court's decision to exclude 413 evidence in that case, they said that it was error for the district court not to appreciate the probative value of the propensity evidence. And again, I think that's exactly what the military judge did. Again, beginning from her misapplication of Hills and her misapplication of the third right factor, saying, that it's arguably not even relevant at all because it's an unproven allegation. So I think if we go through and we look, the military judge really should have looked at the similarities between these cases. And I've gone into more detail in my brief about the facts that the military judge did not consider that she should have, but even if you just look only at the findings of fact that were in the military judge's ruling, you can look at the similarities between these cases. In each case, the military or the appellee attempted to kiss his victim to resistance. He put the actual offense with the touching offense. He reached his hand underneath the clothing of each victim. Each offense occurred in a semi-public area where either others were around or they could be so shortly. And I think it's also relevant that he only stopped committing his offense when he was interrupted by a third party, whether it was the employee of the bowling alley walking into the bathroom, or it was Ms. JD, the girlfriend, popping her head up off of the dashboard in the Jeep. And so the military judge did not even analyze that factor. And I think if we compare this case to Rogers, it shows that it was error for her to do that. I also want to talk in a little bit more detail about the 403 balancing test that the military judge did conduct, and it's contained essentially in paragraph 32 of her ruling. And she talks about the probative weight of the evidence being based on witness testimony, all of which is conflicting with respect to the conduct not charged in this case. And so that's really an inaccurate characterization. There was no witness testimony that was presented at trial that conflicted with what Ms. J.C. testified occurred in the car. The only other person who was actually in the car was Ms. J.B., and what she testified to, as far as like what she actually observed and what she heard, very much mirrored and was identical to what Ms. J.C. said. And so when the military judge says all of this witness testimony was conflicting, she's talking about some of the accounts of some witnesses who did not know the alleged victim, Ms. J.C., and were there for a short period of time that was several hours before the conduct that's actually at issue that occurred in the Jeep. And so that's really a mischaracterization of the facts by the military judge. So in Wright, Taft said that it is not often expected that evidence admissible under MRE 413 will be excluded on the basis of 403. And that certainly is not the case here. This is not a Berry case where the evidence, the 413 evidence, it is so different and so prejudicial because we're essentially characterizing the accused as a child molester that it should be excluded. In fact, this is exactly the type of evidence that the drafters of MRE 413 intended to be admitted. It was very similar. It occurred close in time, only 6 months apart, again, which is another factor that the military judge did not consider. So, if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Please do.
Thank you. The military judge abused her discretion by improperly applying Hills, by incorrectly applying the threshold factors of Wright, and by improperly applying the MRE 403 balancing test. Evidence that Appellee committed abusive sexual contact against Ms. J.C. should be admitted into evidence at his trial for committing abusive sexual conduct against Staff Sergeant R.M. We respectfully ask this court to vacate the military judge's decision to rule that there is no basis for excluding the MRE 413 evidence and to return this case to trial. Thank you.
Counsel, please.
Senior Judge Mayberry, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Lauren Shore, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas McHugh, we represent Staff Sergeant Brian Walters. There is only one question before this court, and that is whether the military judge abused her discretion. She did not. Her decision was well supported within the law. Her findings of fact are not clearly erroneous, nor are her conclusions of law incorrect. It is not whether we agree with the military judge's ultimate conclusion, rather whether there was an abuse of discretion. As Judge Speranza pointed out, the military judge has discretion to determine what, in her own courtroom, will be distracting to the fact finder. She concluded that an allegation of sexual touching made at the behest of a jealous girlfriend by a friend who immediately asked to withdraw the charges, where consent was very much in dispute, that is completely unrelated to the events occurring 6 months prior with an individual not even remotely involved in the events in July, would be a distraction to the fact finder. If there is any case that dictates exclusion of the evidence under the right factors, this is that case. I'd like to make 2 points specifically as we go through this argument. First, although relevant to this decision, the court does not need to answer either party's call to read Hills narrowly or broadly in order to determine whether or not the military judge abused her discretion. Wright gave us the test. Hills did not. Wright is the test that the military judge ultimately applied, and that was the proper test, and she used the proper law, and her conclusions are correct. Second, the military judge properly evaluated the Hills decision and its applicability to this case. Specifically, she did not exclude the evidence under Hills. She simply stated repeatedly that it informed her decision. She then went on to conduct the proper test, which is the right factors, and then the 403 balancing test. So moving first to the 401, 402 logically relevant analysis. Her conclusion was that it was arguably not relevant. She did not conclude that it was not relevant at all, which is why she ultimately goes on to conduct her 403 balancing test, the proper 403 balancing test, and the proper legal analysis as the courts have set out. On page 26 of the government's brief and in their argument, they cite three reasons why evidence would be logically relevant. But the facts of this 413 conduct do not prove any of the things that the government would like it to show. One, that the accused lacks moral inhibitions. With the issues of consent that permeated this entire 413 type evidence, there is a question with regard to all of it as to what it would prove. The government argues that the accused is not deterred by the threat of criminal sanctions because he knew about his other court-martial. Well, that could very much go to show the other hand, which is that it was consensual. So obviously, he wouldn't have conducted further criminal misconduct knowing he was under investigation for others. The fact that we can have a debate about how consensual this was, whether this was logically relevant or legally relevant, shows how much it would be a distraction. Moving on to the 403 balancing test, and this is where the military judge ultimately makes her finding and excludes the evidence. This is the analysis. Kapp has stated, both most recently in Hills and throughout the case law, both in the federal courts and in our jurisdiction, that 413 evidence subject to the 403 balancing test is admissible. It must be tested under 403. Therefore, the military judge ultimately coming to this conclusion and conducting this analysis was exactly right under all of the law that we have under 413. First, addressing the government's, it's essentially a form over substance argument. The government takes great issue with that second to last sentence in paragraph 33 of the military judge's ruling. However, they forget to mention the very next sentence, which she says, thus, under an NRE 403 balancing test, the evidence must fail. She correctly cited the NRE 403 test in paragraph 20 of her ruling. The sentence right before that, where she talks about the prejudice and the probative value, is merely a part of her analysis. That is not the application of the test. We know that she knows the right test. She stated it in paragraph 20. And then a conclusory sentence follows the sentence that the government takes objection to. Moreover, if this court were to agree with the government's argument here, it's essentially to put the government in the position of being able to undo any decision the military judge makes because they do not show the same grammatical choices as government counsel. That is simply not the way the law is handled. The government further takes issue with the military judge's quote-unquote failure to cite all the NRE 403 balancing factors. What was pointed out during oral argument and what the government counsel continues to fail to understand is that none of these factors are exhaustive or are exclusive. There is no exhaustive list, no federal court has adopted any exhaustive test that requires analysis of all of these factors. In fact, one factor can be the deciding one. In this case, the distraction to the fact finder was key. You have an allegation that was made at the insistence of a jealous girlfriend. What we have in the record is JV telling JC that their friendship will be over if she does not press charges before she has ever spoken to JC about whether or not this was consensual conduct. Now, JC twice makes in her testimony statements that she did say beforehand that it wasn't consensual. But when pressed on cross-examination, she admits that she did not say anything until the police arrived. JB is unclear and uncertain whether she even heard JC say stop. JB is quite clear that she heard JC say she saw us, not what JC testified to, which was she saw you. There is this testimony is completely conflicting, and to say that it is not conflicting is a mischaracterization of the record. There is no testimony on what occurred in that car that is in sync with the other. Absolutely none.
Not the touching of the breast. Not Sergeant Walters reaching over her shoulder and touching her. Or JC moving his hands away.
JB does not affirmatively confirm that, Your Honor. She says she assumes that he was touching her breast, but she did not see it. So the conflicting testimony is, whether or not it was consensual. You have the moments after J.B. accusatorily asking, this is her own statement, that I was asking J.C. in an accusing tone, and she said nothing. She had a doe-eyed expression. Whereas J.C. testifies that she immediately said, she saw you. No, I wasn't enjoying this. And so their testimony is completely conflicting with that, with regard to that. And that is the central issue with regard to whether or not this happened. As for debating this, this proves the very point the military judge ultimately concluded. This is distracting. There is this, to lay this out a little more clearly, the charged complainant in this case was mentioned three times in the government oral argument. Seven times did we discuss JC and JB and those factors. The distraction, it's become a mini appellate issue within a case. It would become the mini trial within a trial. Government counsel argued that only one witness would be required. That's on the government side. The defense offered Sergeant T, Ms. J.B., and there were other witnesses, the girlfriend of Sergeant T who was there, who also witnessed the flirtatious nature and J.C. and Sergeant Walters holding hands. All of these things would have to be brought out before the members if this evidence is brought in when you're looking at maybe two witnesses for the named or the actual charged offenses. This is the epitome of distracting for the fact finder. Moreover, in light of the congressional intent or the information that is out there to show us that Congress wanted this type of evidence to be admissible, what was missing in the rest of government counsel's argument was they intended it to be admissible with the military judge or the judge in federal case having total discretion to exclude evidence under MRE 403. That is what makes MRE 413 constitutional. That has been said repeated throughout the case law and frankly through the legislative history as well.
Counsel, before we continue further with 403, I'd like to back up to the beginning of your argument and be crystal clear about what your position is today.
Yes, sir.
So with regard to the judge's consideration of our Superior Court's decision in Hills, and I'm referring to your brief here, you said that the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she concluded the decision in Hills precluded use of allegations of sexual misconduct. If I understand you correctly today, you're not claiming that.
It is appellant's position that Hills would not allow this evidence. However, appellant does not believe that the court has to reach Hills in order to determine that the military judge did not abuse her discretion. That is appellant's argument here. So both government counsel and defense counsel have invited the court to read Hills in a way that we think it should be read. But Hills' applicability, conceding that it is an open question in this case, the facts are distinguishable, as the military judge points out. There is some question as to whether or not CAF would apply Hills to this particular case. Appellee's position is simply, it does apply, but the court does not have to take either of our invitations to read Hills any more broadly or narrowly than it currently stands right now.
And then I suppose similarly with the military judge's assessment of the threshold questions for 413 evidence, under Wright, and finding that arguably this isn't even relevant, so it would be not admissible on that basis as well. Are you essentially saying the same thing, that you're not conceding that the judge was inaccurate or incorrect on that, but ultimately Kelly should prevail because of the 403 analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. That's our point, is that the 403 analysis is the ultimate check on the 413 evidence, regardless of anything else that is discussed. Yes, a judge must go through all of the right factors, but even if the court disagrees, when you look to the 403 analysis, that is the ultimate test of whether or not this 413 evidence is admissible. And again, going back to my initial point, it doesn't matter whether you as judges sitting in her shoes would have reached the same decision. It's whether or not she got the law correct and her findings of fact are fairly supported. If her conclusions are not arbitrary and capricious, she did not abuse her discretion.
But if the judge, the trial judge, is wrong in the application of Hills, wrong on the third prong of the threshold portion of Wright, how can she properly conduct a 403 balancing test and properly weigh the probative value of evidence that she determined arguably is not even logically relevant?
Your Honor, specifically because of the language she used in those last two paragraphs when she argued or discussed the 403 analysis, which was, even if I presume it's this, even if I ignore that argument, even if I ignore this, the Hills analysis, even if I ignore my assumption, even if it is relevant. So when she does her 403 analysis, she assumes, contrary to her prior position, that it is logically relevant. And then she goes on to analyze it for legal relevance. Closing on your question, Judge Johnson, essentially our point is that Hills is not the basis for this decision, and thus it doesn't have to be the court's basis for the decision. Both parties have invited the court repeatedly to read this as a Hills case. It doesn't need to be. The military judge ultimately makes the proper decisions and analysis under the tests that were set out. As I said, Hills didn't give us a test. Wright gave us the test, and she properly applied the right test. As the CAF stated in United States v. Wicks, the abuse of discretion standard calls for more than a mere difference of opinion, or the challenged action must be arbitrary, capricious, clearly erroneous, or unreasonable. Deference must be given to the military judge's decision, and all evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to Sergeant Walters. The military judge did not abuse her discretion. Her findings of fact were well supported in the record, and her conclusions of law were reasonable. We urge the court to deny the government's appeal. I just want to make a couple of points in response. First of all, this court should answer the Hills question in this case, because there cannot be any doubt that that was an important part of the military judge's ruling, and that was certainly part of her reasoning for excluding this evidence. She made clear that she believed that Hills applies to these situations, and that was a reason to exclude the evidence. That she might have offered another reason is not any reason why this court cannot or should not address the Hills issue. And I believe it is certainly important for trial practitioners to know what the law is in this case. So the government would certainly respectfully ask this court to decide that issue and to rule that Hills is not applicable to these situations where we have uncharged misconduct that is charged in another jurisdiction but not charged at the court-martial. Now, I want to again address this distraction of the fact finder prong, because one thing that I did not mention is I think we have to look at how long the testimony actually took on the record. And I believe it was a mere 36 pages of the record that was devoted to this testimony. And that was before, and that was in motions. I mean, that was before, you know, without the military judge potentially making any limitations on the testimony that could come out.
So would 40 be too much? When does it become a distraction? 100 pages?
I think it depends, Your Honor, but I think 36 is certainly in the range where it is not distracting if we're looking at the range. Maybe 200 might be distracting, but again.
But isn't that the point? I mean, we're looking at pages. The trial judge is looking at these witnesses, has an understanding of what the charge misconduct is and what that evidence may be, correct? And that's why we need to defer to their judgment and their discretion as to what would be a distraction in their courtroom.
But I
not
think,
the number of pages, right?
Well, I think so, Your Honor, but I certainly would think that the 36 pages would weigh in favor of the government if we're looking at pure length. Yes, it's certainly not entirely the only part of the calculus. But I think the military judge is also, she's incorrect about the distracting nature, because she, and the one finding of fact that the government challenged in this case in our brief was her finding that there was no sort of indication from Ms. J.C. that this was non-consensual before the police arrived. And I just don't believe that is accurate when you look at the record, when you look at the fact that she was telling the accused no and stop, and he was having to tell her to relax. And Ms. J.B. clearly understood that to be the case. She clearly perceives this to be non-consensual before the police arrived, because we have her testimony, including her testimony that was elicited from the defense counsel, saying that, in her mind, she was thinking of the other charge against Apelli, and she was yelling at him, "This is just like your other case." So the idea that it never came up that this was a sexual assault before the police arrived just has no basis in the record whatsoever. And that was certainly a finding of fact, an incorrect finding of fact, clearly erroneous finding of fact, that infected the military judge's 403 analysis, and something that this court should consider. And then I think, Your Honor, you got it exactly right when you were talking about Hills and the fact that, if the military judge got it wrong with her application of Hills, and she was incorrect in her application of the third prong of the right factors finding that is arguably not relevant at all, that absolutely and completely permeates and infects her 403 balancing test. And it absolutely means that she abused her discretion, because she started from the place where this is not even relevant. And certainly that's not what 413 tells us about propensity evidence. And then she failed to even consider any of the other factors that would weigh in favor of this being admissible and probative evidence. And for those reasons, Your Honor, she allowed her incorrect view of the law to permeate her 403 balancing test, and an incorrect application of the law is completely an abuse of discretion. That's what our Superior Court has said. And grammatical mistakes do matter, Your Honor. When we're talking about Hills infecting her Hills decision infecting a case, grammatical mistakes are important. And I see that I'm out of time. If there are no further questions, that concludes my
I just have one question for you. It's not at all uncommon for a trial judge in making an admissibility of evidence ruling to consider alternative theories. We see that a lot in suppression motions. Well, I'm going to rule on this, whether or not there was probable cause. But if I'm wrong on that, I'm going to move on to whether or not it might have been plain view. And if I'm wrong on that, I'm going to consider whether or not it might have been inevitably discovered. So it's not uncommon for a record to have completely exclusive findings by a military judge. Can you tell me why the findings in this case are different than in a case where we are considering mutually exclusive conclusions of law by a judge based on the facts before them?
Well, Your Honor, is this going to the question of whether or not this court should address Hills or just
no, you,
decision back on the 403 balancing test?
The way I understand it is your position is that 403 can't save her prior errors. Her 403 analysis in this case cannot be read in the absence of the previous decision she made with regards to the right test and other issues.
Well, I wouldn't say that would be true in all cases, Your Honor, but I do believe it's true in this case where the relevance and the probative value of the evidence was infected by her ruling on the Hills issue, and the ruling that because of Hills now, this unproven incident arguably has no relevance. I mean, there is absolutely no way that her view of the law and her view of the relevance did not carry over into her balancing. So while ordinarily, Your Honor, I would agree with you that, you know, a different analysis might save her incorrect ruling on a different theory of admissibility, I don't believe that that is the case here, just because there is so much linkage and part of the balancing test included that the determination of relevancy and the probative value of the evidence.
Any other questions, counsel?
Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. This court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All right.